Welcome to episode 299 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us. I am your host, Ian Martin, and today's episode is a special interview with Tim Wall, owner of Pub Le Ski Lodge in La Tagne in France's Les Trois Vallées ski area. During our conversation, Tim shares his experience of running one of the most famous bars in Les Trois Vallées for over 30 years, including revealing his favourite après-ski bands. We discuss the annual opportunity to toss the boss on Tim's birthday, as well as covering some of the other businesses he has run during his time in the Alps, including La Tiger, Lodge du Village, and The Pit Stop. We find out how the La Tagne Charity Day grew to a massive event hosted by Radio 1's Joe Wiley, and the truth behind Tim's appearance on Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. But before we come to my conversation with Tim, I'd like to thank Tyrol Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, you've already missed out on some great conversations about Tyrol. We've covered Innsbruck, Ischgl, Tyrol West, San Johann in Tyrol, the Ski Vault, Ski Jule, Arlberg, and more. And you can find out about all of these, and I recommend you do. It's been really interesting to find out more about the Tyrol and the Lebensgefühl, that Austrian way of life that connects them all together. Right, I spoke to Tim in the summer of 2025, but I've been saving this episode for the middle of this season. So let's listen to my conversation with Tim Wall, owner of Pub Le Ski Lodge in La Tagne.
I am delighted to be joined today by Tim Wall, the owner of Pub Le Ski Lodge in La Tagne. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, I'm good form. Just getting ready for the summer in La Tagne. Next week.
Whereabouts are you today? You're not in La Tagne yet, are you?
I'm at my house in the southwest, which is just about 20 minutes inland from Hossegor-Capbreton, the big surf areas, and about half an hour from Biarritz.
I know the area well. It's a beautiful part of the world, and I can completely see why you'd like it. I've been to Hossegor and Capbreton and all that area quite a few times. Are you a surfer, Tim?
Everybody says I look like a surfer, but no, I'm not a surfer. I've tried it many times. Hips are starting to go, but great sport. I've worked with Aussies many years and had lots of lessons, but I wouldn't say I'm a good surfer at all. No.
Now, I've been there on holiday, and I've been to La Tagne on holiday many times, and mentioned in the introduction that I was doing ski seasons back in the mid 90s. And I actually discovered when we were chatting earlier that I think I visited the ski lodge in the first year that you were open. Because remind listeners, when did it open?
Well, we opened in 1993, December 1993. It was an empty commercial property in 1993 in September. And I happened to be working in Valmorel, and I spent a summer in Valmorel looking for businesses. And the owner of the apartment that I was renting, he was a big investor. He talked about La Tagne, and he had somebody in line to do the pub for him. Anyway, this guy backed out. I took it on, came and had a look and said, yeah, I can do that. No problem at all. Initially, we're going to go 50-50 in the business. And I just, my lawyer said, no way, you should do it yourself. So, went around all the banks and we opened in 1993, yeah.
Oh, well, you said a couple of things there I'd like to ask you about. Firstly, let's just track back. You said Valmorel. You were working ski seasons there for one of the tour operators?
Yeah, I worked with Nielsen. Nielsen Ski is a tour operator. I was there for 2 or 3 years in Valmorel. It was quite a big operation for us. My wife was also working there, and also then she became area manager, so she was my boss.
So nothing's changed there then, Tim. She was keeping you in line then, and she's keeping you in line now, right?
Yeah, she's always been my boss. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Just out of interest, I mean, I've only been to Valmorel once, and I didn't even get to ski there because I think it was a crystal kind of mid-season meeting or something like that. Well, what's the ski resort like?
The skiing's fantastic. I mean, we were very lucky because Nielsen was a great skiing company. They had great ski guides as well. All their ski guides were actually qualified, and a lot of them did back-to-back seasons from NZ and Australia. So we had all these Aussies and Kiwis that had come over, and they were, you know, really extreme skiers. So we used to go out with them literally every day. Off the back, it's connected with the Morian Valley. So you've got Saint-François-Longchamp. And above Saint-François-Longchamp, you've got the Lozière, and you can drop off the back of the Lozière, and it really is fantastic off beast. In those days, you know, Valmorel wasn't particularly an advanced ski resort, so it wasn't tracked out all the time. So it's great, some great little haunts, yeah.
Definitely one of the advantages, I think, of the maybe the lesser known resorts, that if you're a good skier, you know, if you're in Chamonix or somewhere like that, all of the off-peaks get skied out, you know, before lunchtime. But if you're in somewhere like Valmorel, I'm guessing here, because I haven't skied there, you know, days after, you can still find really good pitches of powder.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. And I mean, you can actually drop off the back of Valmorel down to the Belleville Valley, I think, as well. So that's a great run as well.
So you were looking for a new business. You knew that you wanted to stay in the industry, and you decided that repping probably wasn't the best long-term option there. And so that sounded like, you know, connections worked out really well for you. But did you, I think you said to me earlier that although there was a right to run a pub in Netanya, there wasn't a pub there already. There wasn't a bar there already.
Well, Netanya, we arrived, I think the resort was built for the Winter Olympics. It housed the ice hockey players. There were several businesses there, one of them being the Arbat Saloon, which was also run by the director of the ski school, Fernand Maché, who's actually still there, and his son's a Michelin star restaurateur now. So a great couple, brilliant work ethic. So, yeah, they had the Arbat Saloon, but they didn't really, it wasn't really an English pub as such. It was more of a bit of a French cafe, Western style bar, old school French bar. So we were the main pub. Yeah,
I think you said to me earlier that you kind of built it. What does that mean in that respect?
Well, I took on this empty shell. I mean, there was no plumbing. It had briefly been a part of it had been a ski shop, but somebody had just thrown clothes in there and sold clothes from it from the main door. But we needed to do everything from the plumbing to the electricity to the tiling. So I got a French team in to do the major work. Obviously, you have to have all the conformities. And then had a couple of Kiwis as well that were helping. They do the longer hours. We all lived together and we worked from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. every day, because we had 6 to 8 weeks, I think it was, to get open from that first season. So from an empty shell to an open restaurant, open pub. In 6 to 8 weeks, so it was a difficult time.
No one likes a deadline, but a deadline when the ski season is about to start, and there's a lot of competition for materials and things like that as well. But evidently, you got it open in time. And Netanya back then in 1993, as you said, it was very new. It had only been built for the Albertville Olympics. There was still quite a lot of chalets there. I mean, now wouldn't even be able to say how much bigger it is. Maybe you can. Do you know how many beds there are in Netanya now compared to back then?
Well, Netanya was, I think there was about 1,200 beds when I arrived. There was only one major tour operator, which was Crystal. I think Crystal and Thompson were the two tour operators there. There wasn't that many Brits. Now you've got all the chalets. There was a big chalet program went ahead. And you've probably 5,000 beds now. And there's another 1,000 going in on the Moretta side, on the left-hand side, ready for this year, 2026, I think.
That is amazing. So did you have a sense, you know, when you were selecting that, because you looked at lots of different options, there was going to be this growth? I mean, evidently, it's a bar in the Three Valleys. But at the time, maybe people might have thought, well, it's a bit off the beaten track. You know, will people actually go there?
Well, fortunately for me, my wife, when we started, was still working with Nielsen as area manager. And Nielsen had a massive programme in the Three Valleys as well. Val Thorens, Les Mines Weir, Merivale Monterey, Merivale. And in those days, ski guiding was, was allowed. So every lunchtime, you know, one of the Nielsen crew would come down and come down for lunch. And so we put it on the map, really.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting, because that's sort of how it worked for me, because I was guiding. I was working for a much smaller company at that time. They're called Ski Beach Villas. But in Merivale Monterey, where I was, the Nielsen rep, who was a long-term Nielsen rep, Janie Tonkinson, who I'm guessing you probably know, maybe it was her who said to me, hey, look, you know, when you're taking your guests to Courchevel, you know, stay away from those ritzy, really expensive places. Netanya, perfect place, wonderful terrace, sit in the sun, great service and personality as well. Maybe that's how I ended up there. And probably I was told as a guide, I'd get my free lunch as well.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, the free lunch came into price. You'd have to, you possibly have to serve the drinks for your clients yourself. But in the early days, you know, it wasn't as structured as it is now. But we'd had a lot of the Nielsen crew and Janie, goes back a long way and a husband as well. Ian McCluskey, who's with the ESF, yeah.
Yeah, well, we could go off on a tangent with him, because, again, I had a lot of crossover with those guys when I was doing my seasons in Merivale. But let's come back to the ski lodge itself then. Now, I think, you know, anyone who's been on holiday to Netanya will have been to the ski lodge. I find it unlikely that they wouldn't have gone there, you know, at some point during the course of the week. And, you know, if you've holidayed in the Three Valleys, there's a reasonable chance that you've been there as well. There is always, you know, a great atmosphere there, to my mind. And I think live music of an evening, you know, has always been a key feature of the ski lodge. Was that something that you saw from the beginning? Was there any kind of opposition from locals? I don't know, people who owned apartments nearby to have live music there?
You've obviously done your homework here. There was only two bars in the early 90s. There was two bars that did live music. One was Yorkies, which is a Rompuan, used to be called Yorkies, had all the Kiwis and Aussies. And the other one was the pub in Merivale, the centre of Merivale. Now, I took a lot of staff over from those from Yorkies, came and worked with me, Aussies and Kiwis, and also some of the live bands. The first live band was Shibboleth. There was also a band called Wild Turkey, some Kiwis that came out. They knew people out here. And they brought Jimmy Barnes with them, which is from Cold Chisel. So he played a set at my place as well. So any Aussie knows Jimmy Barnes, you know, he's played with In Excess. So it's such an important part. Like you say, the downside was the noise problem. We spent a lot of money soundproofing the ski lodge, but inevitably with the extraction we had and the big pillars that go through the center, there's going to be a certain amount of noise that escapes. So what I used to do, when we had the live music, I used to knock on all the doors above the apartments, especially during the French holidays, and just say, I've got live music tonight at about 12:30. If you'd like to come down for a drink, by all means do so, and I'll buy you one. But just bear with me, you might hear the odd sound of bass through in your apartment. So that's how it worked.
Beautiful way of dealing with it. You mentioned some of the bands that have played, Shibboleth being one of the early ones. I think Bring Your Sisters, a lot of people would know. One of the ones that has always been, I guess, close to my heart are a band called Superfly, who based themselves in La Tanya during that period. And some listeners may be aware, if they've listened to previous episodes of the podcast, that they then became The Feeling, a very successful band now. I'm guessing Superfly played a few times in the ski lodge.
They brought something a little bit different. They arrived a little bit later after Shibboleth. Bands tend to be all rocky and play the same music. Superfly gave us something different. You know, they had the synthesizer, which was pretty new. They were quite polished. They didn't look like rockers. They looked, you know, they looked like young boys, but they were well presented. And the music was great. And it was a type of music that I really enjoyed. So we had them back several times. And yeah, we've been to see them since, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as The Feeling, I think, some listeners may know that he's a bassist. Richard Jones is married to Sophie Ellis-Bextor, who they ended up meeting when they were doing studio musicians or session musicians for her. I think with Superfly, it's almost like that time in La Tanya was the equivalent of the Beatles' Hamburg years. You know, they were gigging really hard, working, going from resort to resort, you know, every night. And they really, as you said, they were very polished. You know, they really worked their sets well. So it's probably no surprise that they were successful. I mean, of those, all of those bands over the years, is there a favourite one that kind of, you know, stands out to you that, you know, you always enjoyed listening to?
Well, Superfly, obviously, but Bring Your Sisters, they're more, I suppose they're kind of like family to us. They spent many years in La Tanya. They've helped promote my business and they've been very loyal to the ski lodge. Also, Stevie, the drummer, he married my children's nanny. He was often seen in my chalet late at night, popping down to see Della. And they're now married with three children. And my daughter was flower girl over at the wedding in Ireland. So they must be the band that my preference.
Cool. I love that. So as well as the live music, you know, you've always worked hard on having lots of theme days, and you typically see an Australia Day, St. Patrick's Day, seen some great photos of Pirates Day. But one of the highlights of the season, I think, is your birthday, which is typically labelled as Toss the Boss. What day of the winter is that?
Well, that's the 30th of January. 30th of January. Yeah, Toss the Boss has become, I mean, people actually come out to resort for that week. Yeah, we have a coin. Heads or tails, you call. If you get it right, you don't pay for your drink. So I'm on a loser, basically. It's either they pay or the normal price or they don't. But often there are cases when it's mainly for the locals. So some of the locals will lose and I feel so sorry for them that I'll just say, yeah, okay, no worries. You can have it free anyway. So it's a big party. live music, lots of free drink. And we've actually done it for champagne as well. Tossed the coin for champagne, tossed a bottle of champagne. Stevie, bottles of Jaeger as well have been on tossed a coin for. So, yeah, it's a great, great, great night.
I think sometimes it's so with that. I mean, it sounds great. I would guess statistically giving away half of your rounds for free. Is it that someone thinks, oh, my luck is in, I'm going to get a really big round, I'm going to get a round for everyone because it's going to be free, and then they lose the toss?
That does happen. Yeah. People certainly, with shots, people say, oh, I'll have 20 Jaegers, and that's probably 60, 70 euros, and they'll lose. And so, yeah, it does incite people to drink as well. So it's a double-edged sword, really. But
it's a special night during the season. I think probably, if listeners are listening to this now and they've never been to the ski lodge before, they're probably getting a sense for the atmosphere there. And yeah, a lot of that comes from you because you've got a lot of personality that you bring to the job. I mean, you're a magnificent front of house kind of person. One thing that maybe happened more in early years, but you tell me if it still happens now, from time to time, you'll disappear on the terrace and blowing a massive horn, is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that came about when we set up and I told my parents that I was going to do a pub in the mountains. My mother was quite into antiques, so she had this old coach horn. And she said, oh, you've got to put this on the wall. If you're doing a pub, put this on the wall. So, I took the coach horn away. I wasn't going to put it on the wall, but I didn't really know what to do with it. And then when we had the live music, the live sport on TV, we had Sky. It started to come out and I'd give it the old blow when England were playing. Then it kind of progressed to God Save the Queen. I was playing God Save the Queen at the start of the matches. And then it kind of progressed onto the terrace. And it was basically... In the olden days, we had a big terrace and we weren't particularly structured and it was all hands on. And people sometimes had that little bit of a wait for food. It kind of took the wait away for the client. So I'd play God Save the Queen on the horn or Happy Birthday. They're the only two things I'm to play.
Yeah, well, it certainly is entertaining. And, you mentioned the terrace out. I mentioned it earlier. It's like a really a great spot to sit outside, in the sunshine on a beautiful day. And I think you've had quite a few celebrities, pass by over the years. I know there's regulars who come to La Tanya every year, people like Dominic Cork, England cricketer. But are there celebrities who've dropped by on the terrace over the years?
We've had quite a few between the ski lodge and LDV, but it's difficult to recognise them in the, when they're skiing. They're completely covered. And then not on all of them want to let themselves know that they're, in your place. But we've had Eddie Jordan. He came for a couple of burgers a few times. Vince Cable, a great oratist. I had a great chat with him. He's got that lovely, those dulcet tones. It was lovely to listen to him and have a chat with him. We've had, the royalty in Lodge du Village. We've had Prince Edward and Sophie of Wessex. They came out for the British Ski Championships. We were offering Van Cho for the descent of Flumble, the torchlit descent. They were there and we had tapas for them and everything. And I received a lovely letter signed by him saying, thank you for the soiree. So,
oh, I didn't know that one. That's excellent. This would be a good point to link to the charity day because there's a celebrity link in there. And let's come to that. The charity day I find really interesting. I think the first one was in 2002. And it's kind of run every year until COVID. And over the years, that La Tanya Charity Day has raised hundreds of thousands of euros. So I wondered how it started. How did that conversation come about?
Yeah, I think it was in 2002. We had one of our staff members, Dan Prevost, really nice character. He lost his mother to cancer. We used to do quite a bit of charity work anyway, myself and my wife, and we just started to talk about what we could do. It's a brilliant community in La Tanya. It wasn't too big in those days. As I said, there was only 1,200 beds and there was lots of British that started to come into the resort. We just had a meeting. We thought we could do a charity day. We were talking about how we could raise money. And I just said, oh, well, if you raise over 5K, then I'll shave my head off on the terrace. That might bring a few people in. I'd had this massive mullet, which I've got now for the last 40 years. So that's what I did. My hairdresser came up with a pair of scissors and shavers and people were just paying money to take the scissors and chop off for €5 parts of my hair. And I think the first year we raised £6,000. So
that must have been spectacular. I'm guessing you didn't like grow it back and have it shaved off every year. But that charity event grew. I know, you know, when I was working with natives, we got involved with it as well. But I think the celebrity link is Joe Wiley got involved at some point, the Radio 1 at the time DJ. What was her link with that?
As it progressed, the charity day, it became bigger and bigger, and we couldn't really cope with the amount of people that were coming. There was coaches coming from Teens, Val d'Isère. Excuse me, that's my wife's cooking clock. We decided to move it to Merivale Village. We didn't really have the backing of the Latagne local council, the local commune, as it was dependent from Le Perrier. Now it's Courchevel. So we went to Merivale, and Terry Monham was very helpful, the mayor of Merivale. He helped us with the tourist office helped us as well. And we were looking for ideas. It became more of a music festival as well. And Kieran Jardine, who was president, we had an association, Kieran Jardine and Ralph Corner, who were presidents of the charity. Absolutely, they've done loads of work for the charity day. Marvellous characters. Kieran had a contact in the UK with Joe Wiley and managed to get her out here to host the charity day. So it's absolutely fantastic. She did a set. And in those days, it was later on, we were charging for entry. We had some brilliant bands. We had the Dub Pistols. It was a massive event.
You mentioned you move over to Merivale Village and as the event got, you know, too big for Latanya. I think, you know, you said you started charging. By the time you got to that stage, yes, you know, it was an event. It wasn't just a charity day. You're charging for people to come in. You've got security, you've got toilets, you've got fencing, presumably, if you have to get in. I mean, that's a pretty big scale event, right?
That was the main issue in Latanya. We didn't have the security and we didn't have the hygiene side either. And it was just spilling out onto the piste. So we moved to Merivale, a lot more structured. And we charged to get in. As I said, it became more of a music festival, but we had some big names play there as well. But we raised a lot more money for charity. I mean, I think the last year we raised £50,000. So from £6,000 2002 to 50,000 in 2019, I think it was.
And you mentioned before, you know, one of the reasons it worked was because of that community within Latanya initially. Like later on, you have people coming in from all over the Alps to come along. But that community in Latanya, I think part of it maybe is because of the nature of the resort. You know, there were only 1,200 beds, you know, when you started. Even 5,000 is relatively small. And also, you've got this website, latanya.co.uk, which kind of acts as a hub for the resort. Now, regular listeners will know I've spoken to Toffer, the founder of that website, episode 95. I'll put a link into the show notes. Can you remember when you first met Toffer? Because he's another kind of big local personality.
Well, Toffer is an absolute spectacular character. He came out, I think, initially on holiday with a company called Icicles, which was run by Ian and Ron Howe. And they were very good friends of ours. Both their children worked in the ski resorts and they both worked for me. And they used to have great parties. So I used to go up there. And I think Toffer was there a couple of occasions. I met Toffer. We had quite a lot in common. We both liked to drink. We both liked to socialize. We loved football. And we also loved the skiing as well. So that's where we hit it off together. And we've never really looked back. He has done so much for Latanya. In fact, I've got goosebumps just talking about him. He's an absolutely great guy. He's retired now, and his input is absolutely magnificent.
His website, latanya.co.uk, it was always scoring higher than anything official. And I think in the end, the Latanya Tourist Office just realised that there was no point trying to kind of, you know, invest loads of money in their own website because, you know, that's where people ended up going to if they wanted to find out about Latanya. And in fact, if people go there now, if they look on the social media this winter, they'll see regular snow reports, video snow reports that feature you. You are the Latanya Snow Report correspondent, aren't you? How long have you been doing those? Any idea?
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, thanks to Toffer, I do research a little bit. It was in 2007. I think he just used to do a few mini snow reports himself. And then as we got together and we got to know each other pretty well, we decided to do the snow reports. And yeah, that's how it stemmed off. And absolutely, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, he's great. And he has to take a lot of credit again for that. He used to inspire me, yeah.
Your personality comes across through those snow reports as well. And I think you tend to sign them all off with an expression that's developed over the years, get yourselves out here. Do you know how or when that phrase started? Because it's almost like an official, you know, marketing tool for Latanya now, right?
I think EasyJet started to use it now. They use it something like get yourselves out there and not get yourselves out of it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's in 2016, 2017, there may have been a couple of seasons when the snow wasn't particularly brilliant, or we didn't have as much snow regularly throughout the season. So we get one big dump and then we get no snow at all. So sometimes the media, I mean, you know about the media, sometimes it wasn't always positive about ski resorts. Latanya's at 1,400 metres, and I thought a lot of people might be thinking, hey, you know, we're not going to go to Latanya because it's low down, there's not much snow. So that was when we did the snow, you know, the snow reports with get yourselves out here, because it's to show people that there was decent snow and it's north facing, and it's, like I say, it's a fantastic resort. But yeah, I think it was in 2016, 2017, it just became, yeah, get yourselves out here.
And that phrase is now immortalised on the wall of the ski lodge, is that right?
Oh, yeah, we have people come down and they said, oh, they always want to mention on the snow reports. And they'll say, oh, Tim, can you mention me on the snow report? I've got myself out here. We guide them to the little illuminated sign we've got on the stage, get yourselves out here, and they'll have a photo with me or something, or with their family. So yeah, it is. It's become quite a catchy logo.
I love it. You've created an Instagram feature. Now I mentioned Toffer earlier. You know, you two are, you know, great friends. Even though he's a Toonami Newcastle fan, I think you're a Man United fan. You can still be friends with him. But you might live in France, but I think, you know, the two of you also have, you know, a strong shared interest in supporting England at football. And I know, you know, rugby as well. I spoke to Toffer recently. I think he told me he's been to 9 World Cups. You've been to a few World Cups supporting England as well, right?
Yeah, I've probably been to 5 or 6, but also the Euros as well. Because, yeah, I went to Qatar, the most recent one, the World Cup, with Toffer, met Toffer there as well. But I have a lot of old school friends who I travel with, and Toffer has a lot of friends as well. So we all meet up and we have an England away group on WhatsApp. We go and see most matches.
There's almost a Latanya community within the England supporters. I've certainly seen you've got a special pub La Ski Lodge England flag. Do you take that to the different games, one of the ones that you know hang over the edge of the terrace?
Yeah, we do, yeah. I mean, Toffer bought that for me. That was a present for one of my birthdays, I think. Fantastic flag. A little bit too big sometimes because it's very difficult to smuggle it into the ground. I took it to Qatar and I tried to get in. I had a bit of an altercation with the guys on the entrance to the match England-France and nearly got arrested. And I don't think Qatar's really the place where you should get arrested. So we take it to every World Cup and every Euros as well. South Africa it's been to as well, so that flag comes with us, and yeah, we try and hang it at the stadium as well.
And next time people are watching the football and they're looking at all England fans, they can look out for that ski lodge flag. I wonder if I could take you back to a couple of your other projects. You know, we mentioned Mirabel Village, where you're holding the charity day, and for a while you also ran, as well as Pub La Ski Lodge, you were running Lodge du Village as well. Was that your kind of first expansion?
Yes. But I had a pizzeria in Latanya. I don't know whether you know about that, a small pizzeria. I think that was in 1996, 97. I knew an estate agent, the mayor's wife, and she had this little locale of about 20 metres squared. And I saw an option. The people were always asking to change money. So I set up a bureau de change and pizza takeaway in this 20 metre squared, just down from where the creperie is in 1997. Worked well until the euro came in, the bureau de change. But the reason for the pizza takeaway is we delivered to the chalets. Also, we were doing food at the ski lodge, but we couldn't do it all afternoon. So we had walkie-talkies between the ski lodge and the pit stop, it was called. People would say, oh, are you doing food at the ski lodge? And we'd say, yeah, we're doing pizzas. So we'd walkie-talkie a couple of pizzas and they'd run up with them and deliver them in the afternoon when we weren't doing food at the ski lodge.
How did the expansion, or when did the expansion to Lodge du Village come about then?
That was in 2001. Mirabel Village was a pretty new resort and people were talking about a lift going into there. I went across and had a look at the place. The year before, I'd bought an apartment with MGM, Maurice Giraud Montaigne, and they were the promoters of the Mirabel Village. They were building all the chalets and apartments in Mirabel. So I had a contact there I went to look around. I saw there was a ski shop and a supermarket, which was owned by the mayor, and there was a bakery. And in the middle, there was this chalet. So I did a bit of research, and they said, oh, yeah, this is going to be a nice chalet with a vaulted ceiling down below and everything, lovely, lovely chalet. And I thought, that'll make a great bar. So I phoned the guy I knew from MGM and said, I want to buy this place. And he said, well, no, it's a permit for a chalet. You can't buy it. I said, no, I want to buy it. Anyway, cut a long story short, I got through to Maurice Giro, the owner, and I paid well over the odds for this place. It didn't have a building permit for a pub or a restaurant, but I managed to, the mayor had both businesses next door, and he was very helpful. So we managed to create Lodge de Village, and never really looked back. That became my second business, my major business in the Three Valleys.
I didn't realize at the time that there was nothing there before. I guess I thought it was probably like La Tanya, because how long after you bought it did the lift down to Mirabel Village open?
I think the lift was in there already, so it had just gone in, I think possibly the year before. But there was, as I say, there was no bar. It was a no-brainer, really, but it was a big risk. I mean, I didn't really have the money to do it. My good old father just helped me a little bit as I ran out of money trying to finish the furnishings off before we opened. But, it was quite a challenging venture that was to build that place.
Now, so you mentioned the pit stop. Then you had a Lodge de Village. And then for many years, you've been running La Tiger, a restaurant in La Tanya. I mean, it's a beautiful place, really like that. When did you take that over?
Well, again, at my impulsive side, it was the hotel was bought by Gut, who owned the Biblos in Courchevel, 1850, and also the Biblos in Saint-Tropez. For some reason, he bought the Hotel Montana, and they owned the Tiger as well. So he bought the Hotel Montana and the Tiger together. So he exploited the Hotel Montana and didn't really use the it was an existing restaurant, the Tiger was, didn't really exploit that and just had it for staff accommodation. It was really empty for like 16 months. And then one day, one of the guys from Valor who I knew, the estate agent, he came over to my chalet, which was next door but one, and said, Tim, he said, I've got the keys for the Tiger. Do you want to have a look at it? So I said, yeah, no worries. So I was in the garden with Deb, nipped off. Looked and I thought, bloody hell, this is massive. We've got apartments upstairs, staff accommodation, got the lot. I've got to get this place. So I ran back to Debbie. I said, get over here, have a look, because she's a little bit more settled than I am, and she sees things that I don't see. So we ran back together, had a look, and I signed that day without any conditions sponsive, which means that not subject to loan or anything, that I was buying the place. So I signed that day at a price that was well negotiated as well.
Oh, and do you want to just give listeners who are not familiar with it an idea of, you know, what type of restaurant La Tiger is, what sort of food you're serving?
Well, yeah, that's more of a French restaurant. When we set up, there was a market for a decent restaurant. So the first 10 years or so, we had French chefs. We wanted a French chef and French maitre d'. So it was a French side, French cuisine. We did the foie gras. We did fresh fish of the day, local duck breast. And there was a cocktail lounge bar downstairs. And there was the restaurant, a 75-seater restaurant upstairs. We could take people in. They could wait downstairs, have a cocktail, and then go upstairs for the meal. So a little bit more upmarket, should I say. But still with the live music downstairs late on and some party nights on the quieter nights, Sunday night, for example, we bring your sisters.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lovely place if you're in La Tanya to go for, a slightly quieter drink than if you're at the ski lodge and, like say, more cocktails than beers and Jaeger shots, things like that. What year did you take on La Tiger?
That was 2005.
I know you've got a lot of energy, yeah, a lot of businesses there. There must have been a point, you're still running the ski lodge and La Tiger now, there must have been a point when you stopped running the Lodge de Village.
I sold that off in 2014. But prior to that, I'd also operated the hotel as well, the Montana, for 3 years in 2010. Richard Green, by that time, Richard Green and Roger Bourne had brought the hotel. Very, very good business people. They were working with Sodexo for the catering side and the bar. So they had a few problems with the Sodexo, and people were coming to us, the Tiger, to eat to their half board. They were coming to eat at our place. So Richard just said, can you, if I give you a budget, can you just take on the prestation for the bar and restaurant and put a team in and work the Montana bar and restaurant? And I said, yeah, no worries. So I had a team of 15. He wanted French, so I had some French staff, French maitre d', French chefs as well. A little bit harder work, but a very successful 3 years working that. And I really, really enjoyed it.
Blimey, Tim, I had no idea how busy you were around that time. Because evidently, you know, you had the ski lodge going on, the Lodge de Village, the Tiger, and you were doing the staff for the Montana as well. And, you know, a young family, I'm guessing, at the same time. So working super hard.
And three dogs.
And three dogs as well. I have to ask you about another one of your businesses, which is local to where you are now, is the Le Dec in Cap-Breton. And I guess the reason maybe some people might have come across this is because it led to you spending some time with Gordon Ramsay on his show. I think it's called Kitchen Nightmares. What prompted you to get in contact with him to ask him to come along?
We set up the deck in 2011. And the main reason for that was we wanted to keep staff on all year round. We got the hotel, we got some good French staff, we got some great chefs, we got some great management team. So we went down to the Southwest. We were living down there at that time since 2007, 2008 in the summer. We found this business that had gone under, the Baron Rouge, and we changed it completely and built this restaurant called the deck. And the idea was to try and attract the surfing community and have staff all year round contracts to keep them with us, the good ones, keep them loyal. So that worked quite well. We got the surfing community. We had 18 of the top 20 world surfers come and eat at our place. Super. But it wasn't quite doing as well as in the mountains. It was off the beaten track a little bit. It was very difficult to park there. It was on the side of the port. And I'd put my shoulder out here. I'd broken my shoulder. And I was looking at all my old emails. And there was one from a Gordon Ramsay team saying, we're looking for expats who are struggling with restaurants in France or Spain. So I sent a quick email back. This was like 6 weeks after I'd received it. And I said, I've got three restaurants in the mountains doing really well. But I've just set up one last couple of years in the Southwest. And it's not doing that well. It could do better. So they called me. They sent a team out for 48 hours to film. I played to the gallery a little bit, and lo and behold, they said, "Yeah, we'll do the filming. We can do something with you." I didn't realize the concept. I didn't realize it was kind of kitchen nightmares. I wasn't told that. I was under the belief that, you know, any publicity was good publicity, but now I'm thinking different.
It's hard to say, but to put some context around this, I mean, I guess if people haven't seen the program, you know, Gordon Ramsay goes into a business, tries to, you know, analyze it and work out how to help. How long were they there filming for then?
So the film crew come in, they filmed for 170 hours for a 45-minute documentary. Having said that, Ramsay, he's a little bit more evasive. He came in after 4 or 5 days and we were waiting for him. We were saying, when's this guy going to come in? We've got to meet him. Anyway, it was quite low season and I was due to go to Rio de Janeiro. I booked my holiday for the World Cup. I'd had to cancel that with Toffer once again to do this show. And Ramsay turned up on a Monday night, quietest night of the week. Most restaurants are closed, pissing it down with rain. He turns up, phones me, because I wasn't there, it was at 5:30 in the evening. He said, I'm in your shit all of a restaurant. And I said, well, you might be in the wrong one. It's not my restaurant then. Anyway, I turned up and we had a bit of banter. And unbeknown to me, he'd contacted prior 100 people via email and had them in the bar around the corner. And then they sent them in at 7 o'clock in the evening, one by one. Monday night, quietest night, staff are off. I'm used to doing 300 or 400 covers in the mountains, so I didn't have the stock. But I sent Chris, who was my manager at the time, I sent him down to the restaurant, said, grab me some maigre of duck breast, you know, quickly, bring it back up here. So that's when they start filming. So it's reality, but it's, they get what they want. You know, it's they're quite manipulative. Yeah,
that is really interesting. I mean, that they set it up and we know it's all in the edit.
Great character. We had some great off-screen moments. We were belittling each other. We were the bit of banter as well. But a lot of that's edited out. He has to look like the savior. It's the producer that is the main man, that he decides what goes on. And he was taking the staff out every night, trying to dig dirt on me. There's not much you can dig apart from the fact that if I have a drink, I do get a little bit short-tempered sometimes, and that's where they got me on that one bit that everybody quotes.
I don't know about that bit, but I did, I can't remember where I read this, but at one point, you know, in terms of like looking at trying to take things out of context, Gordon Ramsay asked the staff to write something that they didn't like about you as a way of just trying to sort of wind you up.
Oh, that's provoked me. Yeah, I mean, that all that was edited out. So he said, I've just asked all the staff to write a little note saying something that they don't like, particularly like about you. It was in a pine glass, and he took them out of the pine glass, and they were reading them, and they had the microphone on, and they're saying, doesn't that make you angry hearing all these negative comments? And I said, no, it's not too bad, that one. Doesn't it? Surely you're angry hearing all these negative comments. And that's when I just said, you don't want to seem fucking angry. And that's when I let loose. And, of course, that made great TV.
Out of the 170 hours of TV, you know, yeah. Those 10 seconds or what they were looking for, then producer goes, yeah, we got it.
Yeah,
bank that one. Let's move on.
Exactly.
Well, it was really interesting, you know, watching it. But, you know, I don't know. Does it disprove the idiom that all publicity is good publicity? I don't know. Having seen all of your other businesses, they're certainly, you know, running very efficiently. And the point that you make about having to be able to keep staff all year round is a really important one, because if you've got good staff and then they disappear over the summer and you don't get them back again, you want to be able to retain them. But clearly it didn't put you off, that part of France, because you live in that area now. What is it that you said you moved there, I think, in 2007? What is it about the southwest that really appeals to you?
We used to spend a lot of holidays in the south of France, the Mediterranean side. But one, it's too expensive. The security issues as well. We're in a village down here, 20 minutes from the coast. You get a lot more for your money. And I shouldn't say this, but I can leave my door open, you know, when I go out for a run. So it's absolutely fantastic. And you've got the wild coast of the Atlantic, 1 hour from San Sebastian with 12 Michelin star restaurants, you know, 45 minutes from Spain, half an hour from Biarritz, fantastic surfing and beautiful weather. So it's an absolutely gorgeous place. And my kids were schooled down here.
I mean, a great place to bring up children as well. We mentioned Debbie a couple of times, your other or possibly better half, depending how you want to look at it. I mean, you run all of these businesses together. And they say behind every successful man, there's a woman. Although when I was researching and looking for quotes, apparently Jim Carrey said, behind every great man, there's a woman rolling her eyes. Is that how it works with Debbie as well?
That's brilliant from Jim Carrey. I'll have to remember that one. Yeah, I think it's both of those things. Yeah, definitely the eye rolling comes into play. But I can't say enough about my wife. I mean, it will get me quite emotional. I've got goosebumps again. She's an absolutely wonderful character. And there's no way I could have done what I've done without her. No way. She's an absolute rock. And she's, like you say, she curbs my impulsive behavior and she drives me at the same time. I can't say enough. What a marvelous woman. Yeah.
Oh, well, are you making me quite emotional there, Tim, as well? Yeah. I think that's actually a really good way to bring this to a close. I mean, you're a great team. And you've been, you know, running Public Ski Lodge, I can't even work out how many years it is. What do we say? 93. So 32, 33 years now, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. I think hopefully listeners who've been listening to that will have got a bit of an insight into the Ski Lodge and to you. And I'd like to, you know, just congratulate you. Not many people manage to start up a business and make it such a success like that. And it was a bit of a gamble, you know, going in there in the first place, you know, quiet little place off the beaten track. But, you know, your front of house skills and Debbie's rear of house skills, you know, have clearly made it work. So thanks so much for sharing everything with us today, Tim. And I look forward to seeing you out in the mountains again shortly.
Yeah, it's been great to chat to you, Ian, as well. You know, I've known you for many, many years in the Native Day. And I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank all the Tanya community and all my staff as well over the years. Again, goosebump stuff. I couldn't do it without them. So
That's brilliant, Tim. Thanks so much.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Tim. If you did, or even if you didn't, I would love to know. You can leave a message on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @theskipodcast, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. We have had some feedback since our last podcast. Rob Fogg said, "It's great to hear about the Tyrol. We're in the process of planning next year's trip to either the Arlberg or Zillertal regions by train, and your episodes have been assisting us greatly." He also says, "I'm now up to date with all 291 episodes and looking forward to at least another 291 or more in the near distant future." Well, Rob, that is a great effort. Well done. It might take a while to get that far, but I love producing these podcasts, so I certainly plan to keep going. Jack Harvey on Spotify commented on episode 294. He said, "I visited Sousey last March and loved it. We talked about the great prices on that episode." And Jack added, "You can get a whole margarita cooked to order at Mavie's in San Sicario for €8 with great views towards the French border. I'd avoid the busy cafe at the top of Cessna Clavier on your way to Montgenèvre, though." So great tips. Jack, thank you for that. There are now 299 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and a whopping 288 of those were listened to in the last week, which normally means there's someone like Rob working their way through our back catalogue. Look, if you'd like to get some insight into a particular destination, listen to an interview with an Olympian, or find out about the latest kit, just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest. I can tell you in the last week, around 60% of our listeners were in the UK, 20% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Burkina Faso, Sri Lanka, and Mexico. Now, if you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help us, can I ask a favour? Just pause the podcast now and follow us or subscribe on whatever app you're listening to this on. That way you'll never miss an episode. And what would be even better would be if you could give us a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That bumps up the algorithm and helps other people find us. And don't forget, if you're booking Ski Hire this winter, you can save yourself some money by using the code SKIPODCAST at intersportrent.com. I'll put a link in the show notes for that discount to be automatically applied. Right, for now, I'd like to thank my guest today, Tim Wall, for sharing his time with us. I'd like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast this winter. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.